A terrorist attack on a holy shrine in the Iranian city of Shiraz leaves over a dozen pilgrims, including women and children, dead. Condemnations pour in from across the world following a terror attack on the holy shrine in the south of Iran. As Syrian air defenses intercept another Israeli missile attack over the capital, Damascus, shooting down most of the regime's missiles. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, a terror attack on a holy shrine in the Iranian city of Shiraz in Fars province leaves over a dozen people dead. Now, the Interior Minister has confirmed 13 deaths, including women and children. According to provincial officials, over two dozen people were also injured in the attack at Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of Iran's most popular pilgrimage sites. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. A gunman started shooting from one of the entrances to the shrine. He then headed to a main compound, firing at pilgrims and staff. Officials say the perpetrator has been arrested and the situation is being investigated. Earlier, political analysts say Mohsen Abbas gave us his perspective on this terror attack in Shiraz.
Quite clearly, it seems from all the reports so far that this is a particularly Takfiri and Daesh spun attack. Now, we know where the money strings and the puppet strings of the Daesh and Takfiri terrorists go. We know that they go back to the capital, Washington, D.C. They go back to the capitals of Western Europe. It's, first of all, an act of desperation because it shows how desperate the Zaire Western imperialist powers are now to bring down Iran. They are using the interim period of the JCPOA, if you like, agreement lull before the midterm elections that Joe Biden is facing to try and do everything they can, first of all, to frighten and scare the Islamic government into complying. Secondly, to make the population despondent, I think, through these acts of terrorism, upsetting the law and order, creating sort of violent protests, using the pretext of the false pretext of hijab as a way of trying to create color revolutions in Iran. All of it is a sign of desperation. It's a sign that actually they've run out of ideas. They really don't have anything else other than to copy and paste and repeat what they've done in the past.
And earlier, Hakime Sagayabiria, a Tehran University professor, joined us with her take on the terror attack in Shiraz claimed by the Daesh terrorist group.
This is a sad day for the people of Iran, but it is nothing new. And the Islamic Republic has been experiencing this sort of terrorism from the beginning because it is based on a revolution that wants to free the nation from foreign interference. It is based on a revolution that wants to have Iran independent and strong. And of course, there are many enemies that don't want that to happen. And if you look at the foreign elements that are supporting the current riots in Iran, you see that almost all of them have terroristic backgrounds. The goal is basically to create insecurity in the country, create a sense of instability. You know, these kind of terroristic activity actually brings out the truth that what is the real goal of these sort of things that are happening currently.
And the Iranian president Ebrahim Raisi has condemned the terror attack on the Shah Cheragh in Shiraz, saying evil assault will definitely not go unpunished. In a statement, Raisi also expressed condolences to the families of the pilgrims who were killed or injured. He said the country's security and law enforcement apparatus will make the perpetrators and masterminds pay for this crime and regret what they did. The Iranian president added that history shows the country's enemies resort to violence and terror as they failed to break national unity. Deadly terrorist attack has drawn condemnations from several national and international figures. And condemnations continue to pour in from both inside of Iran and abroad following the terror attack on the shrine, which left over a dozen people dead. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has strongly condemned the terrorist attack, saying, "This is exactly what the so-called advocates of human rights want to see in Iran." Nasser Kanani added in a tweet that, "For the false advocates of human rights, the ends justify the means." The attack also drew international reactions. Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, a senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, expressed his condolences and sympathized with the families of the victims. Sayed Amar al-Hakim, the head of Iraq's National Wisdom Coalition, also condemned the attack. The UN chief spokesman, Stéphane Dujarric, condemned the terrorist attack as well, while condoling with the Iranian people. 3 days of public mourning have been announced in the southern Fars province. According to provincial officials, the armed assailant is a 30-year-old man who is not a national of Iran and entered the country from a neighbor. Iran has slapped sanctions on nearly two dozen European Union entities and individuals for supporting terror activities during recent riots in the country. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said those blacklisted include 8 institutions and 12 individuals. He said the bans were imposed in response to the EU's unconstructive measures against the Islamic Republic. Amir Abdullahian said the targeted entities and individuals were found supporting and inciting terror, extremism, and violence in Iran. The top diplomat once again warned the EU against pursuing its failed and well-worn approach toward Iran. Made the remarks during a meeting with a Belarusian counterpart in Tehran. Syria says its air defenses have intercepted another Israeli missile attack over the capital, Damascus, third such strike in less than a week. According to a Syrian military, Israeli missiles targeted a number of posts on the Damascus suburbs. Said air defenses shot down most of the missiles. Military added attack, which was launched from occupied Palestinian territories, only caused material damage. Israel has carried out numerous strikes against Syria, targeting government troops as well as their forces, allied forces, that is. One of the latest such attacks hit the outskirts of Damascus in September, leaving 5 army soldiers dead. The Yemeni government has promised to bring an end to decades of looting and plundering of the nation's natural resources by countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Now, this comes in light of Yemen's military strength to stop the exploitation of its resources. Our Sana'a correspondent Yusuf Mowry reports.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement is doubling down on its threats to target foreign cargo ships attempting to enter Yemeni waters illegally to steal oil and other natural resources. This after the government recently fired warning shots toward a Greek oil ship attempting to illegally load an estimated 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil from a port terminal in the province of Hadramaut. The warning shots forced the Greek cargo ship to abandon its mission and use its own fuel to head back home empty-handed.
This fuel ship was attempting to steal 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil worth millions of dollars. This money is supposed to be allocated to the Central Bank of Yemen, which would then be distributed to pay labor salaries across the country. Unfortunately, this money was transferred to a bank belonging to the Saudi royal family and was used to fund the American-Saudi aggression on Yemen.
According to the government in Sana'a, ending years of plundering and looting of the Yemeni natural wealth is essential to stimulate the Yemeni economy. It also pulls Yemen out of the decades of poverty and economic instability, which has already left millions of Yemenis in poverty. An initiative, the Sana'a government says, is promising to make it a reality. Observers believe that the world now needs to recognize that it is dealing with a new Yemeni nation, one that will never compromise its dignity and sovereignty.
The new identity of Yemen is because people's demands are now being met, whereby the Yemeni people are finally getting what they deserve as they reap the benefit of their natural resources, which used to be exploited and plundered. The latest warning shots we sent are an example of the military and political leadership's strength, pose, and determination to protect the people of Yemen.
Yemen has for decades been described as the poorest country in the Middle East. However, the underlying reasons why that is the case are hardly ever discussed. According to experts we spoke with, one of the main reasons is the systematic exploitation of Yemen's natural wealth by the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
With the latest developments, foreign countries and companies who have a history in plundering Yemen's natural resources will have to think twice about entering the country's waters illegally, as the Ansar Allah movement has made it very clear it will not hesitate to use decisive military force to protect what it calls the Yemeni people's wealth. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
Israel's recent killings of Palestinians in the West Bank has drawn condemnations from the Palestinian Foreign Ministry, as well as many countries. The ministry is now calling on the International Criminal Court to launch a probe into the crimes. To discuss that further, we were joined earlier by our guests in our news review program.
On this segment of the program, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry is calling on the International Criminal Court to probe the Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. The ministry has condemned continued deadly aggression against Palestinians. Also, Iran and Jordan have separately denounced Israeli raids across the occupied territories, calling on the international community to protect Palestinians. Meanwhile, the European Union has expressed its regret over the latest killings in the West Bank, but stopped short of condemning the regime's crimes. The Israeli military raids on Nablus and Ramallah left six Palestinians dead early on Tuesday. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Mona Kandil, who's with us from Ramallah. Also joining us from Amman, Jordan, we have columnist for Palestine Pulse at Al Monitor, Mr. Dawood Kutab. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah. Give us, first of all, your thoughts, what's taking place with regards to the Palestinian Foreign Ministry calling on the International Criminal Court to probe the Israeli crimes, and also bring us up to speed on the recent deadly Israeli aggression against Palestinians.
Well, according to a statement by the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, it said that the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court must carry out his duties and employ all available tools in order to deter Israeli crimes, investigate them, and hold perpetrators accountable. We have mentioned that yesterday Israeli forces carried out a deadly operation in Nablus city, northern the occupied West Bank. They killed five Palestinians. At least two of them were civilians, barbers. They were killed during this operation, and 21 Palestinians were wounded. At the same time, we are speaking, according to our sources yesterday, three of those Palestinians were members or fighters of the newly formed Palestinian group, the Lion's Den. At the end of the day, all the international laws know and say very well that Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, even if they are members of any Palestinian resistance groups or civilians. These are Israeli occupiers. They should leave the Palestinian lands according to all the Palestinians, according to the international laws. So Palestinians have the right at the end of the day to defend themselves. But what's being carried out every day in the occupied West Bank, as what happened yesterday, five were killed in Nablus, one Palestinian teen was killed in Nabi Saleh near Ramallah, because Palestinians went out to express their rejection of the Israeli crimes. So Israel is doing its utmost to prevent Palestinians being engaged in the different forms of resistance.
Mr. Dawood Kutab, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry is calling the ICC to intervene. How can it intervene at this point when the Israeli regime won't cooperate with it? And also, we've seen constant pressure coming from the United States against officials from the ICC who want to get a better picture of what's taking place in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Well, what we're seeing now is the exposure of the lack of will, the political will of the international community. For months and months and months, the Palestinian leadership has been calling on the world to put to action their belief that there is a two-state solution that is possible. They have refused to recognize the Palestinian state. And as a result, and at the same time, the Israelis are refusing to negotiate. So we are in a very difficult political limbo, and there is a political vacuum. There's nobody that is in charge. The Israelis are interested in their own elections. They're not interested in the Palestinian situation. And so because of this political vacuum, there has been lots of warnings that there's going to be an explosion, yet nobody took that into consideration. Now we're seeing some of this explosion bursting up in everybody's face. Both Israelis, the Palestinians, and the international community are trying to figure out how to resolve it. But the solution is very easy. There has to be a political horizon. People have to see hope. Without hope, people will be frustrated. And you see what happens when people are frustrated.
And how can... you mentioned hope. Hope is for changing of the status quo. How can that status quo change when we're seeing a lack of action from international bodies such as the United Nations, such as the Arab League,
absolutely,
such as the European Union?
You're absolutely right. Everybody, including the Islamic Cooperation Council, the Arab League, the UN, everybody is responsible for the state we are in now. And that's why people are taking guns in their own hands, and they're taking the law in their own hands, because they don't see anybody else doing anything. You know, Uday Tamimi, when he was killed, he left a note saying, I know we're not going to defeat the Israelis with one operation, but we need to have hope, because we need to have people need to really think and carry arms to protect our own country and our own land. So we are in a difficult situation. I think the Israelis are mistaken in ignoring the calls of Palestinians for political dialogue, and the international community are refusing to put the proper pressure on them. And that includes the International Criminal Court, because, as you said, International Criminal Court is not allowed to operate in the occupied territories. The Israelis are refusing to investigate, including the crime of killing Shireen Abu Akleh, a well-known journalist. They are not doing anything to prove that they are a country of laws.
All right, thanks a lot. We're going to have to leave it there. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah, and also thanks to Mr. Dawood Khattab joining us from Amman.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. In the U.S., Republican senators on Thursday, 22nd of September, voted to block a bill that would have required so-called dark money groups to disclose their donors, hindering Democrats' efforts to increase transparency in elections. Stay with us for more. Thank you. The Common Dreams website has more on this story. Proponents of democracy responded with disgust on Thursday, 22nd of September, after Senate Republicans filibustered the Popular Disclose Act, which seeks to expose the super wealthy donors who are spending unlimited amounts of undisclosed money to ensure that the US government advances their interests at the expense of the vast majority of the American public. As Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, author of the defeated legislation, said in a Wednesday floor speech, the bill's goal is to prevent corporations and billionaires from using dark money loopholes to spew bile and slime into the nation's political system. After all 49 of his GOP colleagues in attendance voted to prevent debate on the legislation endorsed by President Joe Biden, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse released a statement slamming right-wing lawmakers for fighting to preserve dark money's poisonous influence over American democracy. Today, Senate Republicans stood in lockstep with their mega donors and secretive special interest groups to protect the most corrupt force in American politics, that is, dark money. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a senior member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, added, the American people are fed up with dark money influence campaigns that rig their government against them and stymie their priorities. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was far from alone in condemning the GOP. Once again, Senate Republicans sided with special interest groups and dark money and against honest and transparent political debate, Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington, tweeted. Instead of voting for Disclose Act and cracking down on dark money in our democracy, Republicans blocked it. That's shameful. Michael Sozin, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, said in a statement that at a time when the guardrails of our democracy are undergoing a severe stress test, it's lamentable that the Senate minority continues to give corporations, wealthy special interest groups, and foreign entities the ability to secretly spend vast amounts of money to influence election outcomes in the United States. The Common Dreams website continues. Trevor Potter, president of Campaign Legal Center, added that the failure to advance or even allow debate on democracy is strengthened by casting light on spending an Elections Act or Disclose Act disappoints those of us who have been fighting against the influence of secret spending. More importantly, he said, it deprives voters of important information about who is attempting to influence their vote and allows corruption to prevail by permitting special interest groups to continue anonymously rigging the system in their own favor. It is past time for Congress to enact legislation that bolsters transparency requirements and fulfills voters' rights to know who is spending on election influence, a right that has repeatedly been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, even as the court has struck down other campaign finance and election-related laws. The ability of the nation's wealthiest individuals to translate their disproportionate economic power into political clout has increased exponentially since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision eliminated effective limits on campaign contributions. As Senator Sheldon Whitehouse's office noted, dark money in particular has skyrocketed despite the Supreme Court by an 8-to-1 margin in Citizens United, upholding disclosure requirements as a means for citizens and shareholders to hold elected officials and corporate spenders accountable. According to the Rhode Island Democrat, dark money political spending went from under $5 million in 2006 to more than $1 billion in 2020. Billionaire political spending increased by a factor of 70 from $17 million for the 2008 election to $1.2 billion for the 2020 election. Among other things, the Disclose Act would require organizations spending money in elections, including super PACs and 501c4 dark money groups, to promptly disclose donors who have given $10,000 or more during an election cycle. In addition to election disclosure requirements, the bill requires groups that spend money on advertisements supporting or opposing judicial nominees to disclose their donors. The Disclose Act would shine light on special interest spending to neutralize its toxic effect, giving Americans' voices a chance to be heard, said Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Republicans heeded the wishes of dark money donors today, but the fight to pass this legislation isn't over. The Business Insider has more on the same story. Republican senators on Thursday, 22nd of September, voted to block a bill that would have required so-called dark money groups to disclose their donors, thwarting Democratic efforts to increase transparency in elections. The Democracy is Strengthened by Casting Light on Spending in Elections, or Disclose Act, targets political non-profit groups and super PACs, requiring them to reveal donors who have contributed more than $10,000 during an election cycle. The measure also applies to groups that spend money on advertisements supporting or opposing judicial nominees. The bill failed to advance as 49 Republicans voted against it. Republican Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho did not vote. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer first introduced the bill in 2010, and Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island has reintroduced it in every Congress since, after a landmark 2010 Citizens United versus FEC Supreme Court decision allowed outside groups to spend unlimited sums of money on elections. Nonprofit organizations are not legally obligated to disclose their donors. Super PACs, on the other hand, are subject to federal campaign finance disclosure laws, but their funding often comes from dark money groups. Senator Whitehouse told Business Insider on Wednesday that he believes the GOP's widespread opposition is a demonstration of the party's dependency on dark money. Unfortunately, the Republican Party has become as dependent on dark money as a deep-sea diver is on his air hose, said Senator Whitehouse. And so, even though my colleagues know that the public hates this stuff, they try to respond to that hatred with their own effort to paint us as a dark money party. They have no choice but to vote against the Disclose Act and protect their dark money donors. This is not the first time that Republicans have successfully blocked the bill from reaching the necessary 60 votes to open debate on legislation. It's happened at least 10 times in the past 12 years, including with 2 standalone votes in 2010, 2 votes in 2012, and as an amendment to the budget in 2015.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies. Welcome to another session of Muslim Lady. While you're listening to us from IRB English Radio, I have the very much honor to be your host. And in this studio, as usual, we're talking about topics that concern the Muslim lady. Well, for today's session, We have Sister Zainab in here.
Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Asma.
Wa alaikum assalam. Well, so happy to have you here. As the audience must know, recently we've started a discussion about the book that talks about the lifestyle of Lady Fatima.
Yeah.
And we actually talked about different sort and aspects of these lifestyle. And today, I guess it's time for us to talk about clothing.
Yes. So we have been talking about the individualistic ethics, because we divided them into mm-hmm. the individualistic ones and social ones and spiritual ethics that a person has. So starting with the individual ethics, we came about the table manners, what kind of table manners were practiced in the family of Lady Zahra, salamu alayha, and we covered that. And next important feature that a person does is clothing.
Yeah. How to dress up.
How to dress up. So obviously everyone knows how to dress, but there are some Islamic ethics.
Since we're Muslim ladies,
especially Muslim women should know. I'll just talk about a few ethics about men as well over here. Because you as a Muslim woman, you as a Muslim lady are going to teach this to your husband, to your child, to your mm-hmm. sons, and every man living in your family. So the first very thing our Prophet, may peace be upon him, would take care of in terms of clothes was the cleanliness of clothes mm-hmm. and purity of clothes. These are two different things. First thing is that you have you're wearing very clean clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And second thing, I said pure. Now, what is the difference between the two? Clean is just clean. It does not have any dirt or
physical cleanliness.
Yeah, clothes are like overall clean. What does pure mean?
Mm-hmm.
For example, you have a washed T-shirt or shirt, and then a stain of blood is on it.
So it is now clean, but it has a spot of blood.
It is clean, but it's not pure now because you can't offer, you know, prayers in this. So the first thing they would take care of was cleanliness, mm-hmm. and in the same time, they would make sure that our clothes are pure. Because, you know, you as a mother, go and change the diapers of your kids tens of times.
That is very important, yes.
Tens of times in a day, I mm-hmm. don't know. Or you make your, like when you're in the age of motherhood and you are taking care of your kids, making them go to washrooms and cleaning them and all. While cleaning them, you may get impure yourselves.
Exactly.
So you have to take very, very much care about that, being pure and clean always. So whatever the clothes they would, or like, you know, there are many females I have seen who would like, whenever they would want to take their kids to the washrooms, they would change their, you know, pants or trousers so that it may be very easy for them. Their clothes do not get, you know, nuts or impure.
Mm-hmm.
So cleanliness and purity both were important things. These were the factors that were taken care of in terms of clothing in their family. The second thing, which was very, very important again, was being simple, keeping it simple, you know.
Yeah.
I, as a mother, maybe I wear simple clothes myself, but when it comes to my son or my daughter, I want to make my daughter look like a Cinderella. I want to make my son look like a prince.
Yeah.
I don't keep it simple anymore.
So you yourself are simple, but you do not teach that to your children.
Yes, from you as a Muslim lady have to keep this into consideration. I'm not saying Islam is against making your children look like princes or princesses or like, you know, but there are some people who are brand freaks.
Yeah, and it starts from your early ages.
Exactly. You know, when you are making your child used to expensive clothes, because your child does not understand what is expensive and inexpensive.
Yeah, exactly.
What he understands is your care,
mm-hmm.
is your attention, is your love. So you as a mother, when you're taking care of a child, when you're making him wear clothes, when you're gifting something to your husband, to your father, keep it simple.
Exactly.
Keep it modest and simple. Because sometimes, well, the clothings out there, they are so immodest. They are not simple anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't have simple clothes anymore. So you are in a very biggest challenge to keep your clothings very, very simple. Simplicity was one of the major factors of the clothing of Lady Zahra, salamu alayha. She had two main factors in her clothing. That was simplicity and modesty.
Yeah, that is very true. So, dear listeners, we're talking about the lifestyle of Sayyida Zahra, salamullah alayha. And let's go for a short break. We'll be back in no time. Welcome back, dear ladies. Well, we were talking about how to dress up according to the lifestyle of Sayyida Zahra, salamullah alayha. We got through some points. Sister Zainab has clarified that for us. At the very first point, we talked about purity and then the cleanliness of our dress.
Yeah.
And also the second thing which you mentioned and is very much important, and I guess nowadays we need to care about it, is modesty and simplicity.
Yes, I would explain more on simplicity, but before that I would like to add one more point, is that they would prefer the colors which they would prefer to wear.
Yeah.
So the best color a prophet, may peace be upon him, loved, or his daughter, was the white color.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the scientists, the history, the psychologists have proved that white stands for peace.
Yeah, and it's the symbol of purity.
It's a symbol of purity and also cleanliness. Yeah. Since we were discussing cleanliness and purity, now today, in what measures of cleanliness and purity white is used? Look at the medical centers.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the hospitals. Look at the doctors themselves. They wear white aprons. They have white walls in the hospitals. Whatever they have, white is the base color.
And you know, there's another reason.
Which stands for cleanliness.
Yeah, I guess there's another reason for picking white. Because when something is white and a dirt gets into it, you could easily notice that.
Exactly. There you go. So it has the connotations of cleanliness as well as purity. Mm-hmm. As you rightly mentioned, it's like a kind of slate wherein you very quickly, you know, recognize when the dirt is coming so that you can clean it up. So, yes, white was something they would prefer. Now, coming back to keeping it simple, they would avoid clothes that would make you center of attraction.
Yeah.
But today, unfortunately, we have advertisements. We have so much going on in the media, which tell you, if you buy this kind of brand in the party or wherever you will be going, you will be the center of attraction.
Yeah.
Everyone will be looking at you and you will nail it.
Yeah, you will shine like a diamond.
Exactly. So kind of, you know, persuading our minds that be center of attraction.
It's inculcation, you know.
Which is not a part of our, like, culture, Islamic culture or lifestyle.
Narrations, because the holy book of Quran also have recommended us to live a simple life.
Yeah, but now living a simple life doesn't mean to live an untidy life. That's why I discussed both points. No, the first point that I mentioned was to be tidy, to be clean, to be pure. To take care of what is pure, what is impure. When my dress is getting impure, while you're a mother, you're changing the diapers or you're doing many other things wherein it's possible
that... Taking your child to bathroom or whatever.
It's not always about just child. You're washing clothes of everyone in the family, other, right? You may get impure through one or the other way, or like the blood stains or anything. Mm-hmm. Something gets cut or like, you know, any kind of...
Or even in the kitchen,
means,
so
whenever
it happens.
Through any means, whenever your clothes get impure, try to make them pure as soon as possible. Do not offer prayers in your impure clothes, because that's another topic about like jurisprudence. We are not authorized to, whatever are our main clothes, we are not authorized to offer, you know, our prayers in the impure clothes. So purity and cleanliness is very, very important, because out there, I'll tell you, since I come from Asian culture, we have many, many people, especially living in the rural areas, who would have this concept that the religious people are very untidy people. No.
Which is very wrong.
Which I'm just trying to break this stereotype, you know. if you're seeing someone who is religious and at the same time he's untidy, he's not following the religion completely.
Exactly.
Because the very first thing, the very first ethics of our clothing, as per Islam, is cleanliness.
And we have it in our narrations.
It's to be pure. It's not only just cleanliness. Even it's to be pure, to have a very pure form of clothing. Mm-hmm. Another example of having pure form of clothing is that you don't buy that clothing from haram money. You buy yeah. that from the money that you earn through legal means, not through illegal means.
Yeah,
that's also something that adds to the purity of your clothes. Mm-hmm. It's not just the external stains, as you mentioned before, that it's the physical cleanliness and this one. So something that's other than physical purity is this, that you make sure that whatever you're buying, whatever you're wearing, mm-hmm. you bought that from the money that you earn through legal means.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Sister Zainab. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you, dear listeners. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners of Muslim Lady. We are talking to you, all the ladies from all around the world, where we're talking about how to dress up in the best manner, which is more close to the manners of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, which is, actually, since we're talking about Muslim Lady, the center of our attention is Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha.
So that's what we were talking about, clothing. We yeah. said to keep it simple, to keep it clean, tidy, and pure as well. And we mentioned the differences. Then we said that they would prefer white colors mm-hmm. over other colors. And we said that, again, white connotes a lot of things, the sense of purity, the sense of peace, the sense of cleanliness, and much more.
Yeah.
That's, again, a different topic. We said one of the important things that we discussed was that not to wear something that makes you center of attraction, especially as a woman, especially mm-hmm. as a woman. See, the world is trying to sell you. And earn money.
Exactly.
You as a Muslim lady got to understand this. You got to understand this point, that why I have to be center of attraction mm-hmm. to give money into somebody else's pockets. Just see, when a woman is becoming center of attraction, for example, not having a job or having less clothes or having immodest clothes, the more she has to reveal herself, the more she has to spend on her body.
Exactly.
The more she has to make expenses. And just think about it, as Muslim ladies and as intellectual ladies, where this money is going into? Into the productions, the ones who are giving these beauty products or the dresses which make you look attractive.
It goes to their pocket.
Yeah.
And for their benefit, of course.
Now we have one more question. Does it mean we never have to wear some like fancy kind of dresses? No, it never means that. But not always. You know, sometimes there are parties.
And not in the street, of course.
Yeah. Of course not in the streets.
Yeah.
Of course not. We will reach to that point, you know, Asma. There are so many things which would add to this fact of, you know, clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very, very important things. We will come towards them, inshallah.
Inshallah, maybe in another session. So thank you, Sister Zainab. This was all the time that we had. Dear listeners, we're talking about clothing based to the lifestyle of Sayyidah Zahra, salamullah alayha. And we talked about quite much of facts. So one of them was that she never wore dresses that would make her the just shining in front of everyone, because that's how she's teaching us. In order to keep it simple, to be pure, and to be always tidy and have this cleanliness and purity, even in our dresses and the things which we wear. So this is all for today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell and thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Democracy is under threat in the U.S. Even the midterm elections could leave democracy weaker ahead of the 2024 presidential race. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, The Guardian reported this week on the efforts of tech billionaire Peter Thiel to influence U.S. politics. It's an important piece about more than just this election cycle. Thiel's power shows that Citizens United has done to U.S. democracy. With 3 weeks to go until Election Day, outside groups have already spent some $1.3 billion to influence the outcome of the midterms. Thiel's nearly $30 million in donations account for only a fraction of that nearly unbelievable total, but he represents a very specific kind of influencer. As Kristen Lee told The Guardian, since Citizens United, just 12 mega donors, 8 of them billionaires, have paid $1 out of every 13 spent in federal elections. Billionaires are sponsoring candidates like prized racehorses. The situation is worrying, exceedingly worrying, but not unprecedented. During the Gilded Age, moneyed corporate interests held incredible sway over the U.S. government. Senators who represented the copper-rich state of Montana, for example, were referred to as representing copper rather than representing their constituents or the state itself. Copper magnate William A. Clark bought himself a seat in the Senate by plying the state's legislators, who at the time elected U.S. senators with massive financial gifts. Once Clark's corrupt practices were revealed, his 1889 opponent, also revealingly a copper magnate, worked to have him removed from Congress. Clark came back in 1901, defeating, you guessed it, another wealthy mine owner to win a Senate seat. The citizens of Montana finally took their government back in 1912, enacting a law that barred corporations from intervening financially in elections. That law stood for a century until the Supreme Court struck it down and, inconsistent with Citizens United, decided in 2010. Shortly after the Citizens United ruling, President Obama asked Americans to imagine the power this will give a special interest over politicians. We don't have to imagine anymore, we are living it. Till is a particularly alarming example. Through massive donations to super PACs, which Citizens United brought to the fore, he's using his riches to force his fringe views into mainstream political discourse. He's supporting candidates who spread the false claim that fraud decided the 2020 election. And his money doesn't just force a certain type of candidate into the public eye. It also silences Till's ideological opponents. By working to defeat the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, for example, Till has deterred others from speaking out against the former president. Few politicians can afford to ignore Till and the threat his money holds. We don't have to continue down this road. Many groups, including Brennan Center, have proposed legislation to limit billionaires' influence over elections without running afoul of Citizens United. We don't need a billionaire's approval like the people of Montana did in 1912. Americans can exercise the power they have as citizens and take back the U.S. government. Also, Guardian wrote, Peter Thiel is far from the first billionaire who has wielded his fortune to try to influence the course of American politics. But in an election year when democracy itself is set to be on the ballot, he stands out for assailing a long-standing governing system that he has described as deranged and in urgent need of course correction. The German-born investor and tech entrepreneur, a Silicon Valley disruptor who helped found PayPal alongside Elon Musk and made his fortune as one of the earliest investors in Facebook, has catapulted himself into the top ranks of mega donor class by pouring close to $30 million this year's midterm elections. He's not merely favoring one party over another, but he's supporting candidates who deny the legitimacy of Joe Biden's election as president and have, in their different ways, called for the pillars of the American establishment to be toppled entirely. Till's priorities this midterm cycle have partly aligned with those of Donald Trump, with whom he has had an on-again, off-again relationship since writing him a $1.25 million check during the 2016 presidential campaign. Till, like Trump, has made it his business to end the careers of what he calls the traitorous 10 Republican House members who voted to impeach Trump in the wake of the January 6th insurrection. Four of these members opted not to run for re-election at all, and four more, including Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the House committee investigating January 6th, went down in the primaries. But there are also signs that Till is thinking around and beyond the former president. The lion's share of his largest, $28 million and counting, has been directed towards two business protege who, with his help, have established themselves as Gantley right-wing darlings. J.D. Vance, the best-selling author of the blue-collar memoir Hillbilly Elegy, who is running for Senate in Ohio, and Blake Masters, a self-styled anti-progressive and anti-globalist who is running for Senate in Arizona. Over the past decade, ever since the Supreme Court dramatically loosened the rules of political campaign, giving in its Citizens United decision, Till has placed sizable fortunes on candidates who are not only conservative but have sought to challenge long-standing institutional traditions and break the Republican Party's own norms. Senator Ted Cruz in Texas and Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri, as well as Trump himself. Masters, who has campaigned on the notion that psychopaths are running the country right now and is spoken approvingly of the anti-establishment philosophy of 1990s, Ona Bomber and Vance, a frequent speaker on the university circuit during his book tour days, who now says universities are the enemy, fit the same mold. They and Till all have ties to a branch of the new right known as NatCon, whose adherents believe broadly that the establishment needs to be torn down, much as Till and his fellow Silicon Valley disruptors believed 2 decades ago that the future lay in destroying long-standing business models and practices. Till himself opined as far back as 2009 that he no longer believed democracy to be compatible with freedom and expressed little hope that voting will make things better. While a member of Trump's presidential transition team in 2016, he flashed his institution-busting instincts by proposing that a leading climate change skeptic, William Happer, be appointed as White House science advisor. He also pushed for a libertarian Bitcoin entrepreneur who did not believe in drug trials to head up the Food and Drug Administration. Such proposals were too much even by Trump's iconoclastic standards. Steve Bannon, Trump's ultra-right campaign manager and political strategist, told a Till biographer, "Peter's idea of disrupting government is out there." Till did not respond to a request for an interview, and these representatives did not respond to multiple invitations to comment. Masters and Vance also did not respond to inquiries.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A terrorist attack on a holy shrine.